21. For Eddie, it was, as some wise man had once said, deja vu all over again. He was running with the wheelchair, racing time. The beach had been replaced by the Street of the Turtle, but somehow everything else was the same. Well, there was one other relevant difference. Now it was a railway station, or a cradle, he was looking for, not a freestanding door. Susanna was sitting bolt upright, with her hair blowing out behind her and Roland's revolver in her right hand, its barrel pointed up at the cloudy, troubled sky. The drums thudded and pounded, bludgeoning them with sound. A gigantic dish-shaped object lay in the street just ahead, and Eddie's overstrained mind, perhaps cued by the classical buildings on either side of them, produced an image of Jove and Thor playing frisbee. Jove throws one wide, and Thor lets it fall through a cloud. What the hell, it's Miller time on Olympus anyway. Frisbees are the gods, he thought, swerving Susanna between two crumbling, rusty cars. What a concept. He bumped the chair up on the sidewalk to get around the artifact, which looked like some sort of telecommunications dish, now that he was really close to it. He was easing the wheelchair over the curb and back into the street again. The sidewalk was too littered with crap to make any real time, when the drums suddenly cut out. The echoes rolled away into a new silence. Except it wasn't really silent at all, Eddie realized. Up ahead, the arched entrance to a marble building stood at the intersection of the Street of the Turtle and another avenue. This building had been overgrown by vines and some straggly green stuff that looked like cypress beards, but it was still magnificent and somehow dignified. Beyond it, around the corner, a crowd was babbling excitedly. "Don't stop," Susanna snapped. "We haven't got time to—" A hysterical shriek drilled through the babble. It was accompanied by yells of approval and, incredibly, the sort of applause Eddie had heard in Atlantic City hotel casinos after some lounge act had finished doing its thing. The shriek was choked into a long, dying gargle that sounded like the buzz of a cicada. Eddie felt the hair on the nape of his neck coming to attention. He glanced at the corpses hanging from the nearest speaker pole and understood that the fun-loving pubes of Ludd were holding another public execution. Marvelous, he thought. Now if they only had Tony Orlando and Dawn to sing Knock three times, they could all die happy. Eddie looked curiously at the stone pile on the corner. This close, the vines which overgrew it had a powerful herbal smell. That smell was eye-wateringly bitter, but he still liked it better than the cinnamon-sweet odor of the mummified corpses. The beards of greenery growing from the vines drooped in ratty sheaves, creating waterfalls of vegetation where once there had been a series of arched entrances. A figure suddenly barreled out through one of these waterfalls and hurried toward them. It was a kid, Eddie realized, and not that many years out of diapers, judging by the size. He was wearing a weird little Lord Fauntleroy outfit, complete with ruffled white shirt and velveteen short pants. There were ribbons in his hair. Eddie felt a sudden mad urge to wave his hands above his head and scream, "But we'd say Ludd is O-tay!" "Come on!" the kid cried in a high, piping voice. Several sprays of the green stuff had gotten caught in his hair. He brushed absently at these with his left hand as he ran. "They're gonna do spankers! It's the spanker man's turn to go to the land of the drums! Come on, or you'll miss the whole fakement, gods cuss it!" Susanna was equally stunned by the child's appearance, but as he got closer, it struck her that there was something extremely odd and awkward about the way he was brushing at the crumbles and strands of greenery which had gotten caught in his beribboned hair. He kept using just that one hand. His other had been behind his back when he ran out through the weedy waterfall, and there it remained. How awkward that must be, she thought. And then a tape player turned on in her mind, and she heard Roland speaking at the end of the bridge. "I knew something like this could happen. If we'd seen the fellow earlier, while we were still beyond the range of his exploding egg, damn the luck!" She leveled Roland's gun at the child, who had leaped from the curb and was running straight for them. "Hold it!" she screamed. "Stand still, you!" "Suze, what are you doing?" Eddie yelled. Susanna ignored him. In a very real sense, Susanna Dean was no longer even here. It was Detta Walker in the chair now, and her eyes were glittering with feverish suspicion. "Stop or I'll shoot!" Little Lord Fauntleroy might have been deaf for all the effect her warning had. "House it!" he shouted jubilantly. "You're going to miss the whole show! Spanker's going to—" His right hand finally began to come out from behind his back. As it did, Eddie realized they weren't looking at a kid but at a misshapen dwarf whose childhood was many years past. The expression Eddie had at first taken for childish glee was actually a chilly mixture of hate and rage. The dwarf's cheeks and brow were covered with the oozing, discolored patches Roland called horse blossoms. Susanna never saw his face. Her attention was fixed on the emerging right hand and the dull green sphere it held. That was all she needed to see. Roland's gun crashed. The dwarf was hammered backward. A shrill cry of pain and rage rose from his tiny mouth as he landed on the sidewalk. The grenade bounced out of his hand and rolled back into the same arch through which he had emerged. Detta was gone, like a dream, and Susanna looked from the smoking gun to the tiny sprawled figure on the sidewalk with surprise, horror, and dismay.
"Oh, my Jesus! I shot him! Eddie, I shot him!"
"Graze die!"
Little Lord Fauntleroy tried to scream these words defiantly, but they came out in a bubbling choke of blood that drenched the few remaining white patches on his frilly shirt. There was a muffled explosion from inside the overgrown plaza of the corner building, and the shaggy carpets of green stuff hanging in front of the arches billowed outward like flags in a brisk gale. With them came clouds of choking, acrid smoke. Eddie flung himself on top of Susanna to shield her and felt a gritty shower of concrete fragments, all small ones, luckily, patter down on his back, his neck, and the crown of his head. There was a series of unpleasantly wet smacking sounds to his left. He opened his eyes a crack, looked in that direction, and saw little Lord Fauntleroy's head just coming to a stop in the gutter. The dwarf's eyes were still open, his mouth still fixed in its final snarl. Now there were other voices, some shrieking, some yelling, all furious. Eddie rolled off Susanna's chair, it tottered on one wheel before deciding to stay up, and stared in the direction from which the dwarf had come. A ragged mob of about 20 men and women had appeared, some coming from around the corner, others pushing through the mats of foliage which obscured the corner building's arches, materializing from the smoke of the dwarf's grenade like evil spirits. Most were wearing blue headscarves, and all were carrying weapons, a varied and somehow pitiful assortment of them, which included rusty swords, dull knives, and splintery clubs. Eddie saw one man defiantly waving a hammer. "Pubes," Eddie thought. "We interrupted their necktie party, and they're pissed as hell about it." A tangle of shouts, "Kill the Grays! Kill them both! They've done for Lester! God kill their eyes!" arose from this charming group as they caught sight of Susanna in her wheelchair and Eddie, who was now crouched on one knee before it. The man in the forefront was wearing a kilt-like wrap and waving a cutlass. He brandished this wildly. He would have decapitated the heavy-set woman standing close behind him had she not ducked, and then charged. The others followed, yelling happily. Roland's gun pounded its bright thunder into the windy, overcast day, and the top of the kilt-wearing pube's head lifted off. The sallow skin of the woman who had almost been decapitated by his cutlass was suddenly stippled with red rain, and she voiced a sound of barking dismay. The others came on past the woman and the dead man, raving and wild-eyed. "Eddie!" Susanna screamed and fired again. A man wearing a silk-lined cape and knee boots collapsed into the street. Eddie groped for the Ruger and had one panicky moment when he thought he had lost it. The butt of the gun had somehow slipped down inside the waistband of his pants. He wrapped his hand around it and yanked hard. The fucking thing wouldn't come. The sight at the end of the barrel had somehow gotten stuck in his underwear. Susanna fired three closely spaced shots. Each found a target, but the oncoming pubes didn't slow.
"Eddie, help me!"
Eddie tore his pants open, feeling like some cut-rate version of Superman, and finally managed to free the Ruger. He hit the safety with the heel of his left palm, placed his elbow on his leg just above the knee, and began to fire. There was no need to think, no need to even aim. Roland had told them that in battle a gunslinger's hands worked on their own, and Eddie now discovered it was true. It would have been hard for a blind man to miss at this range anyway. Susanna had cut the numbers of the charging pubes to no more than 15. Eddie went through the remainder like a storm wind in a wheat field, dropping 4 in less than 2 seconds. Now the single face of the mob, that look of glazed and mindless eagerness, began to break apart. The man with the hammer abruptly tossed his weapon aside and ran for it, limping extravagantly on a pair of arthritis-twisted legs. He was followed by two others. The rest of them milled uncertainly in the street.
"Come on, you deuces!"
a relatively young man snarled. He wore his blue scarf around his throat like a rally racer's ascot. He was bald except for two fluffs of frizzy red hair, one on each side of his head. To Susanna, this fellow looked like Clarabelle the Clown. To Eddie, he looked like Ronald McDonald. To both of them, he looked like trouble. He threw a homemade spear that might have started life as a steel table leg. It clattered harmlessly into the street to Eddie and Susanna's right.
"Come on, I say! We can get him if we all stick together!"
"Sorry, guy," Eddie murmured, and shot him in the chest. Clarabelle Ronald staggered backward, one hand going to his shirt. He stared at Eddie with huge eyes that told his tale with heartbreaking clarity. This wasn't supposed to happen. The hand dropped heavily to the young man's side. A single runlet of blood, incredibly bright in the gray day, slipped from the corner of his mouth. The few remaining pubes stared at him mutely as he slipped to his knees, and one of them turned to run.
"Not at all," Eddie said. "Stay put, my retarded friend, or you're going to get a good look at the clearing where your path ends."
He raised his voice.
"Drop 'em, boys and girls, all of 'em, now!"
"You," the dying man whispered, "you gunslinger?"
"That's right," Eddie said. His eyes surveyed the remaining pubes grimly.
"Cry your pardon,"
the man with the frizzy red hair gasped, and then he fell forward onto his face.
"Gunslingers?"
one of the others asked. His tone was one of dawning horror and realization.
"Well, you're stupid, but you ain't deaf," Susanna said, "and that's something anyway."
She waggled the barrel of the gun, which Eddie was quite sure was empty. For that matter, how many rounds could be left in the Ruger? He realized he didn't have any idea how many rounds the clip held, and cursed himself for a fool. But had he really believed it could come to something like this? He didn't think so.
"You heard him, folks. Drop 'em. Recess is over."
One by one, they complied. The woman who was wearing a pint or so of Mr. Sword and Kilt's blood on her face said,
"You shouldn't have killed Winston, missus. 'Twas his birthday, so it was."
"Well, I guess he should have stayed home and eaten some more birthday cake," Eddie said. Given the overall quality of this experience, he didn't find either the woman's comment or his own response at all surreal. There was one other woman among the remaining pubes, a scrawny thing whose long blonde hair was coming out in big patches as if she had the mange. Eddie observed her sidling toward the dead dwarf and the potential safety of the overgrown arches beyond him, and put a bullet into the cracked cement close by her foot. He had no idea what he wanted with her, but what he didn't want was one of them giving the rest of them ideas. For one thing, he was afraid of what his hands might do if the sickly, sullen people before him tried to run. Whatever his head thought about this gunslinging business, his hands had discovered they liked it just fine.
"Stand where you are, beautiful. Officer Friendly says play it safe."
He glanced at Susanna and was disturbed by the grayish quality of her complexion.
"Suze, you all right?"
he asked in a lower voice.
"Yes."
"You're not going to faint or anything, are you? Because no." She looked at him with eyes so dark they were like caves.
"It's just that I never shot anyone before, okay?"
"Well, you better get used to it," rose to his lips. He bit it back and returned his gaze to the five people who remained before them. They were looking at him and Susanna with a species of sullen fear, which nevertheless stopped well short of terror. "Shit, most of 'em have forgotten what terror is," he thought. "Joy, sadness, love, same thing. I don't think they feel much of anything anymore. They've been living in this purgatory too long."
Then he remembered the laughter, the excited cries, the lounge-act applause, and revised his thinking. There was at least one thing that still got their motors running, one thing that still pushed their buttons. Spanker could have testified to that.
"Who's in charge here?" Eddie asked. He was watching the intersection behind the little group very carefully in case the others should get their courage back. So far, he saw and heard nothing alarming from that direction. He thought that the others had probably left this ragged crew to its fate. They looked at each other uncertainly, and finally the woman with the blood-spattered face spoke up.
Spanker was, but when the guy drum started up this time, it was Spanker's stone what come out of the hat, and we set him to dance. I guess Winston would come next, but you did for him with your guide-rotted gun, so you did.
She wiped blood deliberately from her cheek, looked at it, and then returned her sullen glance to Eddie.
"Well, what do you think Winston was trying to do to me with his god-rotted spear?" Eddie asked. He was disgusted to find the woman had actually made him feel guilty about what he had done. "Trim my sideburns?"
"Killed Frank and Luster, too," she went on doggedly. "And what are you, either grays, which is bad, or a couple of god-rotted outlanders, which is worse? Who's left for the pubes in City North? Topsy, I suppose. Topsy the sailor, but he ain't here, is he? Took his boat and went off down river, eh? So he did, and God rot him too, says I."
Susanna had ceased listening. Her mind had fixed with horrified fascination on something the woman had said earlier. It was Spanker's stone what come out of the hat, and we set him to dance. She remembered reading Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, in college, and understood that these people, the degenerate descendants of the original pubes, were living Jackson's nightmare. No wonder they weren't capable of any strong emotion when they knew they would have to participate in such a grisly drawing not once a year, as in the story, but two or three times each day.
"Why?" she asked the bloody woman in a harsh, horrified voice. "Why do you do it?"
The woman looked at Susanna as if she was the world's biggest fool.
"Why? Well, so the ghosts what live in the machines won't take over the bodies of those who have died here, pubes and grays alike, and send them up through the holes in the streets to eat us. Any fool knows that."
"There are no such things as ghosts," Susanna said, and her voice sounded like so much meaningless quacking to her own ears. Of course there were. In this world, there were ghosts everywhere. Nevertheless, she pushed ahead.
"What you call the God drums is only a tape stuck in a machine. That's really all it is."
Sudden inspiration struck her, and she added, "Oh, maybe the Greys are doing it on purpose. Did you ever think of that? They live in the other part of the city, don't they? And under it as well? They've always wanted you out. Maybe they've just hit on a really efficient way of getting you guys to do their work for them." The bloody woman was standing next to an elderly gent wearing what looked like the world's oldest bowler hat and a pair of frayed khaki shorts. Now he stepped forward and spoke to her with a patina of good manners that turned his underlying contempt into a dagger with razor-sharp edges.
"You are quite wrong, Madam Gunslinger. There are a great many machines under Ludd, and there are ghosts in all of them, demonous spirits which bear only ill will to mortal men and women. These demon ghosts are very capable of raising the dead, and in Ludd there are a great many dead to raise."
"Listen," Eddie said, "have you ever seen one of these zombies with your own eyes, Jeeves? Have any of you?"
Jeeves curled his lip and said nothing. But that lip curl really said it all. What else could one expect, it asked, from outlanders who used guns as a substitute for understanding? Eddie decided it would be best to close off the whole line of discussion. He had never been cut out for missionary work anyway. He waggled the Ruger at the blood-stained woman.
"You and your friend there, the one who looks like an English butler on his day off, are going to take us to the railroad station. After that, we can all say goodbye. And I'll tell you the truth, that's going to make my fucking day."
"Railroad station?" the guy who looked like Jeeves the butler asked. "What is a railroad station?"
"Take us to the cradle," Susanna said.
"Take us to Blaine."
This finally rattled Jeeves. An expression of shocked horror replaced the world-weary contempt with which he had thus far treated them.
"You can't go there," he cried. "The cradle is forbidden ground, and Blaine is the most dangerous of all Ludd's ghosts."
"Forbidden ground?" Eddie thought. "Great. If it's a truth, at least we'll be able to stop worrying about you assholes." It was also nice to hear that there still was a Blaine, or that these people thought there was, anyway.
The others were staring at Eddie and Susanna with expressions of uncomprehending amazement. It was as if the interlopers had suggested to a bunch of born-again Christians that they hunt up the Ark of the Covenant and turn it into a pay toilet. Eddie raised the Ruger until the center of Jeeves' forehead lay in the sight.
"We're going," he said. "And if you don't want to join your ancestors right here and now, I suggest you stop pissing and moaning and take us there."
Jeeves and the blood-stained woman exchanged an uncertain glance, but when the man in the bowler hat looked back at Eddie and Susanna, his face was firm and set.
Shoot us if you like, he said. We'd sooner die here than there.
You folks are a bunch of sick motherfuckers with dying on the brain, Susanna cried at them. Nobody has to die. Just take us where we want to go, for the love of God.
The woman said somberly,
But it is death to enter Blaine's cradle, Mum, so it is, for Blaine sleeps, and he who disturbs his rest must pay a high price.
Come on, beautiful, Eddie snapped. You can't smell the coffee with your head up your ass.
I don't know what that means, she said with an odd and perplexing dignity.
It means you can take us to the cradle and risk the wrath of Blaine, or you can stand your ground here and experience the wrath of Eddie. It doesn't have to be a nice clean headshot, you know. I can take you a piece at a time, and I'm feeling just mean enough to do it. I'm having a very bad day in your city. The music sucks. Everybody has a bad case of B.O., and the first guy we saw threw a grenade at us and kidnapped our friend. So what do you say?
Why would you go to Blaine in any case? One of the others asked. He stirs no more from his birth in the cradle, not for years now. He has even stopped speaking in his many voices and laughing.
Speaking in his many voices and laughing, Eddie thought. He looked at Susanna. She looked back and shrugged.
Ardis was the last to go nigh Blaine, the blood-stained woman said.
Jeeves nodded somberly.
Ardis always was a fool when he were in drink. Blaine asked him some question. I heard it, but it made no sense to me, something about the mother of ravens, I think. And when Ardis couldn't answer what was asked, Blaine slew him with blue fire.
Electricity? Eddie asked. Jeeves and the blood-stained woman both nodded.
Aye, the woman said. Electricity. So it were called in the old days, so it were.
You don't have to go in with us, Susanna proposed suddenly. Just get us within sight of the place. We'll go the rest of the way on our own.
The woman looked at her mistrustfully, and then Jeeves pulled her head close to his lips and mumbled in her ear for a while. The other pubes stood behind them in a ragged line, looking at Eddie and Susanna with the dazed eyes of people who have survived a bad air raid. At last the woman looked around.
"Aye," she said, "we'll take you nigh the cradle, and then it's good riddance to bad swill."
"My idea exactly," Eddie said. "You and Jeeves, the rest of you scatter." He swept them with his eyes. "But remember this. One spear thrown from ambush, one arrow, one brick, and these two die." This threat came out sounding so weak and pointless that Eddie wished he hadn't made it. How could they possibly care for these two, or for any of the individual members of their clan, when they dusted two or more of them each and every day? Well, he thought, watching the others trot off without so much as a backward glance, it was too late to worry about that now.
"Come on," the woman said. "I want to be done with you."
"The feeling's mutual," Eddie replied. But before she and Jeeves led them away, the woman did something which made Eddie repent a little of his hard thoughts. Knelt, brushed back the hair of the man in the kilt, and placed a kiss on his dirty cheek.
"Goodbye, Winston," she said. "Wait for me where the tree's clear and the water's sweet. I'll come to you, as sure as dawn makes shadows run west."
"I didn't want to kill him," Susanna said. "I want you to know that. But I wanted to die even less."
"Aye."
The face that turned toward Susanna was stern and tearless.
"But if you mean to enter Blaine's cradle, you'll die anyway. And the chances are that you'll die envying poor old Winston. He's cruel, is Blaine. The cruelest of all demons in this cruel, cruel place."
"Come on, Maud," Jeeves said, and helped her up.
"Aye, let's finish with him."
She surveyed Susanna and Eddie again, her eyes stern but somehow confused as well.
"God's curse my eyes that they should ever have happened on you two in the first place. And God's curse the guns ye carry as well, for they were always the springhead of our troubles."
"And with that attitude," Susanna thought, "your troubles are going to last at least 1,000 years, sugar."
Maud set a rapid pace along the street of the Turtle. Jeeves trotted beside her. Eddie, who was pushing Susanna in the wheelchair, was soon panting and struggling to keep up. The palatial buildings which lined their way spread out until they resembled ivy-covered country houses on huge, run-to-riot lawns, and Eddie realized they had entered what had once been a very ritzy neighborhood indeed.
Ahead of them, one building loomed above all others. It was a deceptively simple square construction of white stone blocks, its overhanging roof supported by many pillars. Eddie thought again of the gladiator movies he'd so enjoyed as a kid. Susanna, educated in more formal schools, was reminded of the Parthenon. Both saw and marveled at the gorgeously sculpted bestiary, bear and turtle, fish and rat, horse and dog, which ringed the top of the building in 2x2 parade, and understood it was the place they had come to find. That uneasy sensation that they were being watched by many eyes, eyes filled equally with hate and wonder, never left them. Thunder boomed as they came in sight of the monorail track. Like the storm, the track came sweeping in from the south, joined the street of the turtle, and ran straight on toward the cradle of Lud. And as they neared it, ancient bodies began to twist and dance in the strengthening wind on either side of them. 22. After they had run for God knew how long, all Jake knew for sure was that the drums had stopped again, Gasher once more yanked him to a stop. This time Jake managed to keep his feet. He had gotten his second wind. Gasher, who would never see 11 again, had not.
Phew! My old pump's doing nip-up, sweetie.
Too bad, Jake said unfeelingly, then stumbled backward as Gasher's gnarled hand connected with the side of his face.
Yarr! He'd cry a bitter tear if I dropped dead right here, wouldn't you? Too likely. But no such luck, my fine young squint. Old Gasher's seen him come and seen him go, and I wasn't born to drop dead at the feet of any little sweet cheeks berry like you.
Jake listened to these incoherencies impassively. He meant to see Gasher dead before the day was over. Gasher might take Jake with him, but Jake no longer cared about that. He dabbed blood from his freshly split lip and looked at it thoughtfully, wondering at how quickly the desire to do murder could invade and conquer the human heart. Gasher observed Jake looking at his bloody fingers and grinned.
Sap's running, ain't it? Nor will it be the last your old pal Gasher beats out of your young tree unless you look sharp. Unless you look very sharp indeed.
He pointed down at the cobbled surface of the narrow alley they were currently negotiating. There was a rusty manhole cover there, and Jake realized he had seen the words stamped into the steel not long ago. Le Merc Foundry, they said.
There's a grip on the side, Gasher said. You see? Get your hands into that and pull away. Step lively now. Maybe you'll still have all your teeth when you meet up with Tick-Tock.
Jake grasped the steel cover and pulled. He pulled hard, but not quite as hard as he could have done. The maze of streets and alleys through which Gasher had run him was bad, but at least he could see. He couldn't imagine what it might be like in the underworld below the city, where the blackness would preclude even dreams of escape, and he didn't intend to find out unless he absolutely had to. Gasher quickly made it clear to him that he did. "It's too heavy for it," Jake began, and then the pirate seized him by the throat and yanked him upward until they were face to face. The long run through the alleys had brought a thin, sweaty flush to his cheeks and turned the sores, eating into his flesh, an ugly yellow-purple color. Those which were open exuded thick, infected matter and threads of blood in steady pulses. Jake caught just a whiff of Gasher's thick stench before his wind was cut off by the hand which had encircled his throat.
"Listen, you stupid cull, and listen well, for this is your last warning. You yank that fucking street head off right now, or I'll reach into your mouth and rip the living tongue right out of it. And feel free to bite all you want while I do it, for what I have runs in the blood, and you'll see the first blossoms on your own face before the week's out, if you lives that long. Now do you see?"
Jake nodded frantically. Gasher's face was disappearing into deepening folds of gray, and his voice seemed to be coming from a great distance.
All right.
Gasher shoved him backward. Jake fell in a heap beside the manhole cover, gagging and retching. He finally managed to draw in a deep, whooping breath that burned like liquid fire. He spat out a blood-flecked wad of stuff and almost threw up at the sight of it.
"Now yank back that cover, my heart's delight, and let's have no more natter about it."
Jake crawled over to it, slid his hands into the grip, and this time pulled with all his might.
For one terrible moment, he thought he was still not going to be able to budge it. Then he imagined Gasher's fingers reaching into his mouth and seizing his tongue, and found a little extra. There was a dull, spreading agony in his lower back as something gave there, but the circular lid slipped slowly aside, grinding on the cobbles and exposing a grinning crescent of darkness.
"Good, Kelly, good," Gasher cried cheerfully. "What a little mule you are. Keep pulling, don't give up now."
When the crescent had become a half-moon and the pain in Jake's lower back was a white-hot fire, Gasher booted him in the ass, knocking him a sprawl.
"Very good," Gasher said, peering in. "Now, Kelly, go smartly down the ladder on the side. Mind you don't lose your grip and tumble all the way to the bottom, for those rungs are fearsome, slick, and greasy. There's 20 or so, as I remember. And when you get to the bottom, stand stock still and wait for me. You might feel like running from your old pal, but do you think that would be a good idea?"
"No," Jake said. "I suppose not."
"Very intelligent, old son,"
Gasher's lips spread in his hideous smile, once more revealing his few surviving teeth.
"It's dark down there, and there are 1,000 tunnels going every which way. Your old pal Gasher knows them like the back of his hand, so he does, but you'd be lost in no time. Then there's the rats. Very big and very hungry they are. So you just wait."
"I will."
Gasher regarded him narrowly.
"You speak just like a little triggy, you do, but you're no pube. I'll set my watch and warrant to that. Where are you from, Squint?"
Jake said nothing.
"Bumbler got your tongue, do he? Well, that's all right. Tick-Tock'll get it all out of you, so he will. He's got a way about him, Ticky does. Just naturally wants to make people converse. Once he gets them going, they sometimes talk so fast and scream so loud someone has to hit him over the head to slow him down. Bumblers ain't allowed to hold no one's tongue around the Tick-Tock man, not even fine young triggers like you. Now get the fuck down that ladder. Hup!"
He lashed out with his foot. This time Jake managed to tuck in and dodge the blow. He looked into the half-open manhole, saw the ladder, and started down. He was still chest-high to the alley when a tremendous stone-like crash hammered the air. It came from a mile or more away, but Jake knew what it was without having to be told. A cry of pure misery burst from his lips. A grim smile tugged at the corners of Gasher's mouth.
"Your hard-case friend trailed you a little better than you thought he would, didn't he? Not better than I thought, though, Cully, for I got a look at his eyes. Very pert and cunning they were. I thought he'd come out of his juicy little night nudge right smart if he was to come at all, and so he did. He spied the tripwires, but the fountains got him. So that's all right. Get on, sweet cheeks."
He aimed a kick at Jake's protruding head. Jake ducked it, but one foot slipped on the ladder, bolted to the side of the sewer shaft, and he only saved himself from falling by clutching Gasher's scab-rattled ankle. He looked up, pleading, and saw no softening on that dying, infected face.
"Please," he said,
and heard the word trying to break into a sob. He kept seeing Roland lying crushed beneath the huge fountain. What had Gasher said? If anyone wanted him, they would have to pick him up with a blotter.
"Beg if you want, dear heart. Just don't expect no good to come of it, for mercy stops on this side of the bridge, so it does. Now go down, or I'll kick your bleeding brains right out your bleeding ears."
So Jake went down, and by the time he reached the standing water at the bottom, the urge to cry had passed. He waited, shoulders slumped and head down, for Gasher to descend and lead him to his fate. 23. Roland had come close to tripping the crossed wires which held back the avalanche of junk, but the dangling fountain was absurd, a trap which might have been set by a stupid child. Court had taught them to constantly check all visual quadrants as they moved in enemy territory, and that included above as well as behind and below. "Stop," he told Oi, raising his voice to be heard over the drums.
"Up," Oi agreed,
then looked ahead and immediately added,
"Fake!"
"Yes." The gunslinger took another look up at the suspended marble fountain, then examined the street, looking for the trigger. There were two, he saw.
Perhaps their camouflage's cobblestones had once been effective, but that time was long past. Roland bent down, hands on his knees, and spoke into Oi's upturned face. "Going to pick you up for a minute now. Don't fuss, Oi."
"Oi?"
Roland put his arms around the bumbler. At first Oi stiffened and attempted to pull away, and then Roland felt the small animal give in. He wasn't happy about being this close to someone who wasn't Jake, but he clearly intended to put up with it. Roland found himself wondering again just how intelligent Oi was. He carried him up the narrow passage and beneath the hanging fountain of Lud, stepping carefully over the mock cobbles. Once they were safely past, he bent to let Oi go. As he did, the drums stopped.
"Ake!" Oi said impatiently. "Ake, ake!"
"Yes, but there's a little piece of business to attend to first." He led Oi 15 yards farther down the alley, then bent and picked up a chunk of concrete. He tossed it thoughtfully from hand to hand, and as he did, he heard the sound of a pistol shot from the east. The amplified thump of the drums had buried the sound of Eddie and Susanna's battle with the ragged band of pubes, but he heard this gunshot clearly and smiled. It almost surely meant that the Deans had reached the cradle, and that was the first good news of this day, which already seemed at least a week long. Roland turned and threw the piece of concrete. His aim was as true as it had been when he had thrown at the ancient traffic signal in River Crossing. The missile struck one of the discolored triggers dead center, and one of the rusty cables snapped with a harsh twang. The marble fountain dropped, rolling over as the other cable snubbed it for a moment longer, long enough so that a man with fast reflexes could have cleared the drop zone anyway, Roland reckoned. Then it, too, let go, and the fountain fell like a pink, misshapen stone. Roland dropped behind a pile of rusty steel beams, and Oi jumped nimbly into his lap as the fountain hit the street with a vast, shattery thump. Chunks of pink marble, some as big as carts, flew through the air. Several small chips stung Roland's face. He brushed others out of Oi's fur. He looked over the makeshift barricade. The fountain had cracked in two like a vast plate. "We won't be coming back this way," Roland thought. The passageway, narrow to begin with, was now completely blocked. He wondered if Jake had heard the fall of the fountain, and what he had made of it if he had. He didn't waste such speculation on Gasher. Gasher would think he had been crushed to paste, which was exactly what Roland wanted him to think. Would Jake think the same thing? The boy should know better than to believe a gunslinger could be killed by such a simple device. But if Gasher had terrorized him enough, Jake might not be thinking that clearly. Well, it was too late to worry about it now, and if he had it to do over again, he would do exactly the same thing. Dying or not, Gasher had displayed both courage and animal cunning. If he was off his guard now, the trick was worth it. Roland got to his feet. "Oi, find Jake."
"Jake?"
Oi stretched his head forward on his long neck, sniffed around in a semicircle, picked up Jake's scent, and was off again, with Roland running after. 10 minutes later, he came to a stop at a manhole cover in the street, sniffed all the way around it, then looked up at Roland and barked shrilly. The gunslinger dropped to one knee and observed both the confusion of tracks and a wide path of scratches on the cobbles. He thought this particular manhole cover had been moved quite often. His eyes narrowed as he saw the wad of bloody phlegm in a crease between two nearby cobbles. "The bastard keeps hitting him," he murmured. He pulled the manhole cover back, looked down, then untied the rawhide lacings which held his shirt closed. He picked the bumbler up and tucked him into his shirt. Oi bared his teeth, and for a moment Roland felt his claws splayed against the flesh of his chest and belly like small, sharp knives. Then they withdrew, and Oi only peered out of Roland's shirt with his bright eyes, panting like a steam engine. The gunslinger could feel the rapid beat of Oi's heart against his own. He pulled the rawhide lace from the eyelets in his shirt and found another, longer lace in his purse. "I'm going to leash you. I don't like it, and you're going to like it even less, but it's going to be very dark down there." He tied the two lengths of rawhide together and formed one end into a wide loop, which he slipped over Oi's head. He expected Oi to bare his teeth again, perhaps even to nip him, but Oi didn't. He only looked up at Roland with his gold-ringed eyes and barked,
"Ake!"
again in his impatient voice. Roland put the loose end of his makeshift leash in his mouth, then sat down on the edge of the sewer shaft, if that was what it was. He felt for the top rung of the ladder and found it. He descended slowly and carefully, more aware than ever that he was missing half a hand and that the steel rungs were slimy with oil and some thicker stuff that was probably moss. Oi was a heavy, warm weight between his shirt and belly, panting steadily and harshly. The gold rings in his eyes gleamed like medallions in the dim light. At last the gunslinger's groping foot splashed into the water at the bottom of the shaft. He glanced up briefly at the coin of white light far above him. "This is where it starts getting hard," he thought. The tunnel was warm and dank and smelled like an ancient charnel house. Somewhere nearby, water was dripping hollowly and monotonously. Farther off, Roland could hear the rumble of machinery. He lifted a very grateful Oi out of his shirt and set him down in the shallow water running sluggishly along the sewer tunnel. "Now it's all up to you," he murmured in the bumbler's ear. "To Jake, Oi! To Jake!
Jake!"
the bumbler barked, and splashed rapidly off into the darkness, swinging his head from side to side at the end of his long neck like a pendulum. Roland followed with the end of the rawhide leash wrapped around his diminished right hand. 24. The cradle, it was easily big enough to have acquired proper noun status in their minds, stood in the center of a square 5 times larger than the one where they had come upon the blasted statue. And when she got a really good look at it, Susanna realized how old and gray and fundamentally grungy the rest of Lod really was. The cradle was so clean it almost hurt her eyes. No vines overgrew its sides, no graffiti daubed its blinding white walls and steps and columns. The yellow plains dust which had coated everything else was absent here. As they drew closer, Susanna saw why. Streams of water coursed endlessly down the sides of the cradle, issuing from nozzles hidden in the shadows of the copper-sheathed eaves. Interval sprays created by other hidden nozzles washed the steps, turning them into off-and-on waterfalls.
"Wow," Eddie said.
"It makes Grand Central look like a Greyhound station in buttfuck Nebraska."
"What a poet you are, dear," Susanna said dryly.
The steps surrounded the entire building and rose to a great open lobby. There were no obscuring mats of vegetation here, but Eddie and Susanna found they still couldn't get a good look inside. The shadows thrown by the overhanging roof were too deep. The totems of the beam marched all the way around the building, 2 by 2, but the corners were reserved for creatures Susanna fervently hoped never to meet outside of the occasional nightmare, hideous stone dragons with scaly bodies, clutching, claw-tipped hands, and nasty, peering eyes. Eddie touched her shoulder and pointed higher. Susanna looked and felt her breath come to a stop in her throat. Standing astride the peak of the roof, far above the totems of the beam and the dragonish gargoyles, as if given dominion over them, was a golden warrior at least 60 feet high. A battered cowboy hat was shoved back to reveal his lined and careworn brow. A bandana hung askew on his upper chest, as if it had just been pulled down after serving long, hard duty as a dust muffle. In one upraised fist, he held a revolver. In the other, what appeared to be an olive branch. Roland of Gilead stood atop the cradle of Lud, dressed in gold. "No," she thought, at last remembering to breathe again. "It's not him. But in another way, it is. That man was a gunslinger. And the resemblance between him, who's probably been dead 1,000 years or more, and Roland is all the truth of content you'll ever need to know." Thunder slammed out of the south. Lightning harried racing clouds across the sky. She wished she had more time to study both the golden statue which stood atop the cradle and the animals which surrounded it. Each of these latter appeared to have words carved upon them, and she had an idea that what was written there might be knowledge worth having. Under these circumstances, however, there was no time to spare.
A wide red strip had been painted across the pavement at the point where the Street of the Turtle emptied into the Plaza of the Cradle. Maud and the fellow Eddie called Jeeves the butler stopped a prudent distance from the red mark.
"This far and no farther," Maud told them flatly. "You may take us to our deaths, but each man and woman owes one to the gods anyway, and I'll die on this side of the deadline no matter what. I'll not dare Blaine for outlanders."
"Nor will I," Jeeves said. He had taken off his dusty bowler and was holding it against his naked chest. On his face was an expression of fearful reverence.
"Fine," Susanna said. "Now scat on out of here, both of you."
"Ye'll backshoot us the second we turn from you," Jeeves said in a trembling voice. "I'll take my watch and warrant on it, so will."
Maud shook her head. The blood on her face had dried to a grotesque maroon stippling.
"There never were a back-shooting gunslinger, that much I will say. We only have their word for it that that's what they are."
Maud pointed to the big revolver with the worn sandalwood grip which Susanna held in her hand. Jeeves looked, and after a moment he stretched out his hand to the woman. When Maud took it, Susanna's image of them as dangerous killers collapsed. They looked more like Hansel and Gretel than Bonnie and Clyde, tired, frightened, confused, and lost so long in the woods that they had grown old there. Her hate and fear of them departed. What replaced it was pity and a deep, aching sadness.
"Fare you well, both of you," she said softly.
"Walk as you will, and with no fear of harm from me or my man here."
Maud nodded.
"I believe you mean us no harm, and I forgive you for shooting Winston. But listen to me, and listen well. Stay out of the cradle. Whatever reasons you think you have for going in, they're not good enough. To enter Blaine's cradle is death."
"We don't have any choice," Eddie said, and thunder banged overhead again as if in agreement.
"Now let me tell you something. I don't know what's underneath Ludd and what isn't, but I do know those drums you're so whacked out about are part of a recording, a song that was made in the world my wife and I came from."
He looked at their uncomprehending faces and raised his arms in frustration.
"Jesus, pumpkin pie, Christ, don't you get it? You're killing each other over a piece of music that was never even released as a single."
Susanna put her hand on his shoulder and murmured his name. He ignored her for the moment, his eyes flicking from Jeeves to Maud and then back to Jeeves again.
"You want to see monsters? Take a good look at each other, then. And when you get back to whatever funhouse it is you call home, take a good look at your friends and relatives."
"You don't understand," Maud said. Her eyes were dark and somber. "But you will. Ah, you will."
"Go on now," Susanna said quietly. "Talk between us is no good. The words only drop dead. Just go your way and try to remember the faces of your fathers, for I think you lost sight of those faces long ago."
The two of them walked back in the direction from which they had come without another word. They did look back over their shoulders from time to time, however, and they were still holding hands, Hansel and Gretel, lost in the deep, dark forest.
"Let me out of here," Eddie said heavily.
He made the Ruger safe, stuck it back in the waistband of his pants, and then rubbed his red eyes with the heels of his hands.
"Just let me out, that's all I ask." "I know what you mean, handsome."
She was clearly scared, but her head had that defiant tilt he had come to recognize and love. He put his hands on her shoulders, bent down, and kissed her. He did not let either their surroundings or the oncoming storm keep him from doing a thorough job. When he pulled back, at last she was studying him with wide, dancing eyes.
"Wow, what was that about?"
"About how I'm in love with you," he said.
"And I guess that's about all. Is it enough?" Her eyes softened. For a moment she thought about telling him the secret she might or might not be keeping, but of course the time and place were wrong.
She could no more tell him she might be pregnant now than she could pause to read the words written on the sculpted portal totems.
"It's enough, Eddie," she said. "You're the best thing that ever happened to me."
His hazel eyes were totally focused on her.
"It's hard for me to say stuff like that. Living with Henry made it hard, I guess, but it's true. I think I started loving you because you were everything Roland took me away from. In New York, I mean. But it's a lot more than that now. Because I don't want to go back anymore, do you?"
She looked at the cradle. She was terrified of what they might find in there, but all the same, she looked back at him.
"No, I don't want to go back. I want to spend the rest of my life going forward. As long as you're with me, that is. It's funny, you know, you saying you started loving me because of all the things he took you away from. Funny how. I started loving you because you set me free of Detta Walker."
She paused, thought, then shook her head slightly.
"No, it goes further than that. I started loving you because you set me free of both those bitches. One was a foul-mouthed, cock-teasing thief, and the other was a self-righteous, pompous prig. Comes down to six of one and a half dozen of the other, as far as I'm concerned. I like Susanna Dean better than either one, and you were the one who set me free."
This time it was she who did the reaching, pressing her palm to his stubbly cheeks, drawing him down, kissing him gently. When he put a light hand on her breast, she sighed and covered it with her own.
"I think we better get going," she said, "or we're apt to be laying right here in the street, and getting wet from the look."
Eddie stared around at the silent towers, the broken windows, the vine-encrusted walls a final time. Then he nodded.
"Yeah, I don't think there's any future in this town anyway."
He pushed her forward, and they both stiffened as the wheels of the chair passed over what Maud had called the deadline, fearful that they would trip some ancient protective device and die together. But nothing happened. Eddie pushed her into the plaza, and as they approached the steps leading up to the cradle, a cold, wind-driven rain began to fall. Although neither of them knew it, the first of the great autumn storms of Midworld had arrived. 25. Once they were in the smelly darkness of the sewers, Gasher slowed the killing pace he'd maintained above ground. Jake didn't think it was because of the darkness. Gasher seemed to know every twist and turn of the route he was following, just as advertised. Jake believed it was because his captor was satisfied that Roland had been squashed to jelly by the deadfall trap. Jake himself had begun to wonder. If Roland had spotted the tripwires, a far more subtle trap than the one which followed, was it really likely that he had missed seeing the fountain? Jake supposed it was possible, but it didn't make much sense. Jake thought it more likely that Roland had tripped the fountain on purpose, to lull Gasher and perhaps slow him down. He didn't believe Roland could follow them through this maze under the streets. The total darkness would defeat even the gunslinger's tracking abilities, but it cheered his heart to think that Roland might not have died in an attempt to keep his promise. They turned right, left, then left again. As Jake's other senses sharpened in an attempt to compensate for his lack of sight, he had a vague perception of other tunnels around him. The muffled sounds of ancient laboring machinery would grow loud for a moment, then fade as the stone foundations of the city drew close around them again. Drafts blew intermittently against his skin, sometimes warm, sometimes chilly. Their splashing footfalls echoed briefly as they passed the intersecting tunnels from which these stenchy breaths blew, and once Jake nearly brained himself on some metal object jutting down from the ceiling. He slapped at it with one hand and felt something that might have been a large valve wheel. After that he waved his hands as he trotted along in an attempt to read the air ahead of him. Gasher guided him with taps to the shoulders as a wagoner might have guided his oxen. They moved at a good clip, trotting but not running. Gasher got enough of his breath back to first hum and then begin singing in a low, surprisingly tuneful tenor voice.
Ribble to tibble to ting ting ting, I'll get a job and buy you a ring. When I get my mitts on your jiggly tits, ribble to tibble to ting ting ting. Oh, ribble to tibble, I just want to fiddle, fiddle around with your ting ting ting.
There were five or six more verses along this line before Gasher quit.
Now you sing something, Squint.
I don't know anything,
Jake puffed. He hoped he sounded more out of breath than he actually was. He didn't know if it would do him any good or not, but down here in the dark any edge seemed worth trying for. Gasher brought his elbow down in the center of Jake's back, almost hard enough to send him sprawling into the ankle-high water running sluggishly through the tunnel they were traversing.
You better know, Summit, unless you want me to rip your ever-loving spine right out your back.
He paused, then added,
There's haunts down here, boy. They live inside the fucking machine, so they do. Singing keeps them off, don't you know that? Now sing!
Jake thought hard, not wanting to earn another love tap from Gasher, and came up with a song he'd learned in summer day camp at the age of 7 or 8. He opened his mouth and began to bawl it into the darkness, listening to the echoes bounce back amid the sounds of running water, falling water, and ancient thudding machinery.
My girl's a corker, she's a New Yorker. I buy her everything to keep her in style. She got a pair of hips just like two battleships. Oh boy, that's how my money goes. My girl's a dilly, she comes from Philly. I buy her everything to keep her in style. She's got a pair of eyes just like two pizza pies. Oh boy, that's how
Gasher reached out, seized Jake's ears as if they were jug handles, and yanked him to a stop.
There's a hole right ahead of you, he said. With a voice like yours, Squint, it'd be doing the world a mercy to let you fall in, so it would. But TikTok wouldn't approve at all, so I reckon you're safe for a little longer.
Gasher's hands left Jake's ears, which burned like fire, and fastened on the back of his shirt.
Now lean forward until you feel the ladder on t'other side, and mind you don't slip and drag us both down.
Jake leaned cautiously forward, hands outstretched, terrified of falling into a pit he couldn't see. As he groped for the ladder, he became aware of warm air, clean and almost fragrant, whooshing past his face, and a faint blush of rose-colored light from beneath him. His fingers touched a steel rung and closed over it. The bite wounds on his left hand broke open again, and he felt warm blood running across his palm.
Got it?
Gasher asked.
Yes.
Then climb down. What are you waiting for, goddammit?
Gasher let go of his shirt, and Jake could imagine him drawing his foot back, meaning to hurry him along with a kick in the ass. Jake stepped across the faintly glimmering gap and began to descend the ladder, using his hurt hand as little as possible. This time the rungs were clear of moss and oil and hardly rusted at all. The shaft was very long, and as Jake went down, hurrying to keep Gasher from stepping on his hands with his thick-soled boots, he found himself remembering a movie he'd once seen on TV, Journey to the Center of the Earth. The throb of machinery grew louder, and the rosy glow grew stronger. The machine still didn't sound right, but his ears told him these were in better shape than the ones above. And when he finally reached the bottom, he found the floor was dry. The new horizontal shaft was square, about 6 feet high, and sleeved with riveted stainless steel. It stretched away, for as far as Jake could see in both directions, straight as a string. He knew instinctively, without even thinking about it, that this tunnel, which had to be at least 70 feet under Lud, also followed the path of the beam. And somewhere up ahead, Jake was sure of this, although he couldn't have said why, the train they had come looking for lay directly above it. Narrow ventilation grills ran along the sides of the walls just below the shaft ceiling. It was from these that the clean, dry air was flowing. Moss dangled from some of them in blue-gray beards, but most were still clear. Below every other grill was a yellow arrow with a symbol that looked a bit like a lowercase T. The arrows pointed in the direction Jake and Gasher were heading. The rose-colored light was coming from glass tubes which ran along the ceiling of the shaft in parallel rows. Some, about one in every three, were dark, and others sputtered fitfully, but at least half of them were still working. Neon tubing, Jake thought, amazed. How about that? Gasher dropped down beside him. He saw Jake's expression of surprise and grinned.
Nice, isn't it? Cool in the summer, warm in the winter, and so much food that 500 men couldn't eat it in 500 years. And do you know the best part, Squint? The very best part of the whole koozie fakement?
Jake shook his head.
Farkin' pubies don't have the leastest idea the place even exists. They think there's monsters down here. Catch a pubie going within 20 feet of a sewer cap less than he has to.
He threw his head back and laughed heartily. Jake didn't join in, even though a cold voice in the back of his mind told him it might be politic to do so. He didn't join in because he knew exactly how the pubes felt. There were monsters under the city. Trolls and boggarts and orcs. Hadn't he been captured by just such a one? Gasher shoved him to the left.
Garn! Almost there now. Up!
They jogged on, their footfalls chasing them in a pack of echoes. After 10 or 15 minutes of this, Jake saw a watertight hatchway about 200 yards ahead. As they drew closer, he could see a big valve wheel sticking out of it. A communicator box was mounted on the wall to the right.
"I'm blown out," Gasher gasped as they reached the door at the end of the tunnel. "Doings like this are too much for an invalid like your old pal, so they are."
He thumbed the button on the intercom and bawled,
"I got him, Tick-Tock. Got him as dandy as you please. Didn't even muss his hair. Didn't I tell you I would? Trust the gasser man, I said, for he'll lead you straight and true. Now open up and let us in."
He let go of the button and looked impatiently at the door. The valve wheel didn't turn. Instead, a flat, drawling voice came out of the intercom speaker. "What's the password?" Gasher frowned horribly, scratched his chin with his long, dirty nails, then lifted his eye patch and swabbed out another clot of yellow-green goo.
"Tick-tock and his passwords," he said to Jake. He sounded worried as well as irritated. "He's a trig cove, but that's taking it a deal too far, if you ask me, so it is."
He pushed the button and yelled,
"Come on, Tick-tock, if you don't recognize the sound of my voice, you need a hairy aid."
"Oh, I recognize it," the drawling voice returned. To Jake, it sounded like Jerry Reed, who played Burt Reynolds' sidekick in Smokey and the Bandit. "But I don't know who's with you, do I? Or have you forgotten that the camera out there went tits up last year? You give the password, Gasher, or you can rot out there." Gasher stuck a finger up his nose, extracted a chunk of snot the color of mint jelly, and squashed it into the grill of the speaker. Jake watched this childish display of ill temper in silent fascination, feeling unwelcome hysterical laughter bubbling around inside him. Had they come all this way through the booby-trapped mazes and lightless tunnels to be balked here at this watertight door simply because Gasher couldn't remember the TikTok man's password? Gasher looked at him balefully, then slid his hand across his skull, peeling off his sweat-soaked yellow scarf. The skull beneath was bald, except for a few straggling tufts of black hair like porcupine quills, and deeply dented above the left temple. Gasher peered into the scarf and plucked forth a scrap of paper.
"God's bless Hoots," he muttered. "Hoots takes care of me right proper, he does."
He peered at the scrap, turning it this way and that, and then held it out to Jake. He kept his voice pitched low, as if the TikTok man could hear him, even though the talk button on the intercom wasn't depressed.
"You're a proper little gentleman, ain't you? And the very first thing they teach a gentleman to do after he's been learned not to eat the paste and piss in the corners is read. So read me the word on this paper, Cully, for it's gone right out of my head, so it has."
Jake took the paper, looked at it, then looked up at Gasher again. "What if I won't?" he asked coolly. Gasher was momentarily taken aback at this response, and then he began to grin with dangerous good humor.
"Why, I'll grab you by the throat and use your head for a door knocker," he said. "I doubt if it'll convince old Ticky to let me in, for he's still nervous of your hard-case friend, so he is. But it'll do my heart a world of good to see your brains dripping off that wheel."
Jake considered this, the dark laughter still bubbling away inside him. The TikTok man was a trig enough cove, all right. He had known that it would be difficult to persuade Gasher, who was dying anyway, to speak the password, even if Roland had taken him prisoner. What TikTok hadn't taken into account was Gasher's defective memory. Don't laugh. If you do, he really will beat your brains out. In spite of his brave words, Gasher was watching Jake with real anxiety, and Jake realized a potentially powerful fact. Gasher might not be afraid of dying, but he was afraid of being humiliated. "All right, Gasher," he said calmly. "The word on this piece of paper is bountiful.
Give me that!"
Gasher snatched the paper back, returned it to his scarf, and quickly wrapped the yellow cloth around his head again. He thumbed the intercom button.
"Tick-tock, you're still there?"
"Where else would I be, the west end of the world?" The drawling voice now sounded mildly amused. Gasher stuck his whitish tongue out at the speaker, but his voice was ingratiating, almost servile.
"The password's bountiful, and a fine word it is, too. Now let me in, gods cuss it."
"Of course," the TikTok man said. A machine started up somewhere nearby, making Jake jump. The valve wheel in the center of the door spun. When it stopped, Gasher seized it, yanked it outward, grabbed Jake's arm, and propelled him over the raised lip of the door and into the strangest room he had ever seen in his life.